My name's Dave Emery, and it's my pleasure to be joined by Ed Haslam, the author of Mary, Fairy, and the Monkey Virus, the story of an underground medical laboratory published in softcover by the Wordsworth Press, copyright 1995. Ed, welcome back to our airwaves.
Thank you.
We have been discussing events that took place in New Orleans and around Tulane Medical School and the Ochsner Medical Clinic in the 1960s and early 70s. Alton Ochsner was one of the most important people in American medicine and also a very prominently connected political animal, not only in New Orleans but elsewhere. His connections involved some extreme right-wing and national security connections. He also was the head of the Information Council of the Americas, or one of the dominant person behind that. That was a right-wing propaganda outfit with apparent intelligence connections that was involved with helping to paint Lee Harvey Oswald red in the New Orleans area. One of his employees, one of his colleagues, I should say, at the Ochsner Clinic and also at Tulane, although he was not with Tulane at that time, Mary Sherman, one of the foremost cancer researchers in the United States, was involved in an underground medical laboratory with David Ferry, a paramilitary right-winger involved with the intelligence community's efforts against Castro and the major initial focal point of Jim Garrison's investigation into President Kennedy's assassination. His untimely death and the murder of Eladio de Valle, his apparent control in the anti-Castro effort, helped to cover that up. We have been speaking about the murder of Dr. Mary Sherman and the circumstances surrounding that. It was bandied about by the press that this was some sort of a lesbian quarrel or something like that. And, in fact, that was not the case. We left off with that. Was there not, Ed, some superficial mutilation of her genitals, but nothing like what the press made out?
Well, I think the first thing I want to say is when people do ask me what the book is about, I simply say it's an investigation of the death of Mary Sherman, and it really is what the book comes to. It's the major part of the investigation. Mary Sherman's death was portrayed as a psychosexual slashing, and that her body was set on fire, and the police, as reported through the newspaper, went on this wild goose chase looking for a lesbian slasher, and they played up that theme so much that the precinct captain complained about the manpower shortage and everything else. I mean, that was the whole thrust of their investigation. Nobody could get near the files on this. This file was kept locked in a police officer's desk, and it was not part of the regular filing system. 30 years later, this file was finally released into the basement of the New Orleans Public Library, which is where I found it. And when you read the autopsy report and the police report of what happened to Mary Sherman, you realize that everything they said was a lie. And we start with what did happen to Mary Sherman. What did the body look like?
She apparently had a number of very serious and lethal stab wounds. So, as I said, the whole lesbian sort of homophobic cover-up angle came.
Let me start with the stab wounds, because that's a good place to start.
Okay.
The cause of death, as stated in the coroner's report, was a stab wound to the heart. Okay, this was a precise, done with a very narrow instrument, and she was stabbed exactly and completely, perfectly in the middle of her heart, and it penetrated that thickest wall, the biggest muscle in the heart, the thickest wall right up there in the front, and she hemorrhaged from there. She hemorrhaged over a quarter blood, and that is the wound that killed her. Okay, every other stab wound on her body did not hemorrhage, and that means it was done after death.
Huh.
So the slashing, as it's called, was not done when she was alive. It was done after her death, and it was done in order to create the impression that she had died in a psychosexual incident.
And apparently the inflictor of the fatal heart wound had a high degree of medical knowledge.
He certainly knew how to kill, or he or she certainly knew how to kill somebody because of the precision of that wound. In fact, they didn't even find that wound because they lifted up her left breast and did it right on the seam where her breast would normally hang and went straight in between the fifth and sixth ribs. It wasn't until they literally started to take apart her chest cavity in the autopsy that they even found the wound. So that was very precise. Whoever did it knew what they were doing, but they did it for a reason, and that is what the burns indicate.
Now, when the body was found, there had been some clothing that had been piled on and I believe also under the body and set afire?
That's right. It was basically a mattress fire, and there had been some synthetic clothing on top. The criminologist working for the New Orleans Police Department identified the material in the clothing and said that that material burst into flames at 500 degrees. That means the temperature in the room was less than 500 degrees because that material did not burn completely. It was only partially burned. Also, the curtains next to her bed did not burn. Some of the furniture in the room was smoldering a little bit, but the police who arrived on the scene before the fire department got there did not even report seeing a flame. It was all just a smoldering fire of less than 500 degrees. The problem comes in when you analyze the body. Mary Sherman's right arm, her right rib cage, and the right side of her head was completely burned off, totally disintegrated. Now, the temperatures required to burn a bone are enormous. In a commercial cremation, a body is put into a oven that's 2,000 degrees, and it stays there for 2 hours. And when they open it up, there are still bones, because bones don't burn. They dehydrate. And then the mortuary service grinds up the bones and makes them into dust. So even the 2,000 degrees at 2 hours does not burn a bone. Even guys, pilots who crash jets and get soaked in jet fuel, it burns at thousands of degrees. When they go to pick up the wreckage, their bones are still there. Whatever hit Mary Sherman on the right arm and took off her right arm, her right rib cage, was thousands of degrees. Now, here comes the real interesting point. The easiest thing to burn on your entire body is your hair. We've all burned hairs on our arms or whatever, around the stove, etc. They burn quickly, the low temperatures and everything else. The hair on Mary Sherman's head was still there. The hair on her body was still there. In relationship to some of these burns, the hair was 2-3 inches away. What could have created thousands of degrees of temperature so specifically that it completely burned off and charred and cauterized her right shoulder area, completely destroyed and disintegrated all the bones in her hand and arm and rib cage, and not burned the hair that was right next to it?
In attempting to answer that obvious, and I believe you did successfully answer it, in attempting to answer that obvious and massive discrepancy, you came upon an hypothesis which brings us back to not only the clandestine laboratory, but Mary Sherman's work with David Ferry in injecting mice with cancer-causing monkey viruses. And in many ways, that's discrepancy in her death brings us to some of the central points of your narrative.
There's only really two things that could create the type of damage that we saw on Mary Sherman's body. One of them is a bolt of lightning, or an equivalent electrical charge of millions of volts of electricity, or millions of watts of electricity, hitting her in a blast or a bolt and burning off the everything in its path in the process. One of the curious questions is, why is it only her arm and head area, and why didn't it go all the way down through her body and create similar damage in other places? The other thing that could have done it would have been a beam of radioactivity, and we are familiar with some similar incidents and accidents that occurred with certain machinery that created radioactivity. One of the pieces of machinery that creates radioactivity is called a linear particle accelerator. This is sort of the poor man's atom smasher. It is used in, the most famous one today is out in Linda Loma, California, at the cancer center out there. It shoots radiation into patients and is used to burn their tumors in there. A linear particle accelerator is of that 1964 generation, was a 5 million watt machine that was fully capable of producing either a lightning bolt strength spark or a beam which could cut anything. I mean, let me just give you an illustration of the power of these machines in South Africa in the diamond industry down there. They take yellow diamonds, which are regular diamonds with quartz imperfections in them, and they put them in front of the beam, and it strips the quartz out from the middle of the diamond. These things are capable of cutting anything because they shoot subatomic particles.
Now, you theorize that the accelerator, and we're going to update the information you developed since your book was published, but you theorize about this linear particle accelerator, which may have been the device, which appears to have been the device that caused this incredible burning on Barry Sherman, as having been connected with the work that she may have been engaged in this underground laboratory, namely investigating cancer-causing viruses. Could you tell us a little more about what you think was going on in that laboratory in connection with the accelerator and the cancer-causing viruses? And we're going to get back to not only Mary Sherman's medical work, but the formidable efforts of two of her female colleagues, Sarah Stewart and Bernice Eddy, also pioneers in this field and also sadly overlooked, perhaps because of their gender.
Okay, let's start with the linear particle accelerator and why it was that I brought that into the conjecture of what happened to Mary Sherman. First of all, I was told in 1969 that there was a linear particle accelerator in New Orleans, which was being used for medical research, which was not being discussed publicly. And I was told that by a Jesuit priest because I attended the Jesuit school, and he happened to be our physics teacher, and we happened to be talking about linear particle accelerators that day in class when this conversation came up. So I had a fairly high level of confidence that the Jesuit priest was telling us the truth, and this was information he had heard through whatever circles he associated with through his priesthood activities and his teaching physics activities. The question that raised is, what were they doing with a linear particle accelerator that was medical and that was in the category of research that they wouldn't want to talk about? And that raised the possibility that Mary Sherman, if she died in proximity to a linear particle accelerator, was using that linear particle accelerator in her research. And was that research the same research that was involved with David Ferry's lab? In other words, was she using a linear particle accelerator on monkey viruses to mutate them? Was she mutating monkey viruses and then seeing what happened with the viruses when they put them into the mice? And that was the critical question that I had to find an answer to. And that's when we went back to David Ferry's treatise, the treatise that was found in his apartment, and we traced the whole story back to the National Institute of Health and the discovery of cancer-causing viruses by Mary Sherman's medical school classmate, Sarah Stewart, who was working as a researcher for the National Cancer Institute and the National Institute of Health. And in 1957, Sarah Stewart and Bernice Eddy, Bernice Eddy was the head of the safety testing laboratory. It was called Biostandards, but the safety testing laboratory at the National Institute of Health. And she and Sarah Stewart proved that they found a virus, which they named polyoma, and they proved that this virus was capable of causing multiple types of cancer in multiple types of animals. And for the first time, they proved that viruses were capable of causing cancers in mammals. The history of virus and cancer goes back all the way to the beginning of the century in the research of, I'm sorry, I can't think of his name at the moment, but he identified the chicken sarcoma virus, Peyton Rouse in 1911, who started this whole theory of viruses were capable of causing cancer. But it wasn't until 1957 when these two researchers at the National Institute of Health proved it to the satisfaction of their management that it was taken seriously in projects to further research cancer-causing viruses were, in fact, financed by the U.S. government through the National Institute of Health. Bernice Eddy is worth talking about because when the polio vaccine came up for distribution, the Salk vaccine originally, at the last minute, they brought the Salk vaccine into Bernice Eddy to safety test. Bernice Eddy had a bunch of monkeys at her disposal, and she went and injected them with the Salk vaccine. And the monkeys fell over dead and crippled on the bottom of her cages, of their cages. And Bernice Eddy took photographs of them and went to the management of the National Institute of Health prior to the release of the polio vaccine and showed them these photos. And they released it anyway. And when they released it, children died and children got paralyzed just like the monkeys did. And the result of that was called the Cutter fiasco, because Cutter was the lab that made the that batch of the the vaccine, and it was the biggest political disaster in American medical history. And it was so bad that not only was the director of the National Institute of Health fired, but the Secretary of Health Education and Welfare, who oversaw that department, was also fired.
And this was in 1957?
This was in 1955 this occurred.
Okay.
Dwight Eisenhower was president. Richard Nixon was vice president. Okay, there's only two people in the government that can fire the Secretary of Health, Education, and Welfare, and it's always the vice president's job because the president doesn't want to do it.
Mm-hmm. So it was actually Alton Oxner's friend, Richard Nixon, who did the firing, and one of Oxner's sons was among the early victims of this faulty vaccine.
Oxner was interested in proving to the public that the vaccine was safe, so he injected his own two grandchildren with it. His grandson died. His granddaughter got polio from it. Mm-hmm. So he was personally affected by this initial batch of the polio vaccine. Richard Nixon was then presented with the task of fixing the problem. And the Salk vaccine was withdrawn, and they went with Albert Sabin's vaccine, which did not try to kill the polio virus. Sabin simply isolated a benign strain of it, so your body would know that it was being invaded by something and would defend against it, but the polio virus that they gave you was so weak that it couldn't really hurt you. So in 1957, they went ahead with the second, 56, 57, they went ahead with the second wave of polio vaccines with the mass inoculation. Now, the thing that most people don't know about the polio vaccine is when you have to grow a live polio virus to use in a vaccine, where do you do it? They did it on the kidneys of monkeys. And when they took the virus, the polio virus, out of the monkey for the vaccine, they also took out the other viruses that were in the monkeys.
And some of those were apparent cancer-causing viruses.
And that was the discovery, this polyoma virus that Stuart and Eddy discovered in 57. Yale Labs the next year started categorizing all the monkey viruses, and they found a virus that was identical to polyoma, which was SV40. And Bernice Eddy, quietly and secretly and without the knowledge of the NIH management, started running her own experiments and doing her own research, and what she found was cancer-causing monkey viruses present in the cells of the monkey's kidneys upon which the vaccine was grown. And she raised the issue, have we just mass inoculated the American public with cancer-causing monkey viruses? And when I got to that point in the research, I said, wait a minute. If that happened, and if Eddy was right, then we would be having an epidemic of cancer right now. And nobody's talking about an epidemic of cancer right now, so it must not have happened, right? And then the little voice went off in the back of my head that said, Ed, go check the numbers yourself.
It's just like that silly notion that there was a conspiracy behind Kennedy's assassination.
Yeah, that silly notion.
Everybody knows that's not true, and he can just check with Gerald Posner.
That's right. And so I went to a medical library. I pulled the statistics from the National Cancer Institute for the last 16 years, and I put them on my computer and punched the button to make it turn into a graph, and they're clearer than, I mean, just like sticking out like a sore thumb, are four cancers which have increased an average of 50% over that same 16-year period. Now, the significance of that is this, because people are going to say, well, there's all this environmental stuff, blah, blah, blah. They track 37 cancers, okay? One of them is lung cancer, and I'm going to throw that out just because of the cigarette issue, okay? And then we're talking about four that are growing at epidemic proportions. The other 32 cancers over the 16-year period had a 0% increase. So all of the increase was focused on these four cancers, and they're all soft tissue cancers. They are breast and prostate, which are both sexual organs. They are skin, melanoma of the skin, and they are lymphoma. Okay, those four have been in fact, you will see Science Magazine published an article on breast cancer. They called the rise in breast cancer alarming. Now, alarming is a strange word, I mean, strong word for Science Magazine, okay? The breast cancer is up 35%. It is the lowest of the four. The melanoma of the skin is up 90% in the same 16-year period. Now, how many people are we talking about here? We're talking about 500,000 cases of cancer a year in comparison to the 33,000 cases of polio a year. And that 500,000 cases is consuming $250 million of medical insurance premiums a day. Okay?
Wow.
This is the secret. This is the skeleton in the closet. This is the thing that nobody wants to talk about, and Richard Nixon is the ultimate political power behind it because he is the one who restructured the National Institute of Health and authorized the Sabin vaccine to proceed.
We're going to talk about the National Institute of Health and the National Cancer Institute's viral cancer research program a little later. But one of the things, again, that you theorize concerning this clandestine laboratory employing two of the strangest political bedfellows, Dr. Mary Sherman, one of the foremost medical personalities and cancer researchers in this country, and David Ferry, a paramilitary intelligence-connected right-winger, apparently involved with the Kennedy assassination. They were working together in this clandestine laboratory, which may very well have occurred under the stewardship of Alton Oxner and perhaps Guy Bannister. And they were working on injecting mice with monkey viruses to produce cancer. And you have theorized that that may have been connected with the contamination of the polio vaccine, and that perhaps the linear particle accelerator that may have inflicted those ghastly injuries on Mary Sherman was connected with that.
Yeah, I think that's a pretty accurate summary. Let me point out just one or two things. We have the claim from Jim Garrison that David Ferry and Mary Sherman worked together. Nobody else has any hard evidence that they personally knew each other and personally worked together. But that does not prevent the other scenario happening, which is that David Ferry was given Mary Sherman's mice upon her death in order to continue to observe them. So until, you know, I have asked Jim Garrison, chief investigator who was responsible for this claim, to tell me what he knows about it, and he won't talk to me about it. So until we get an answer on it one way or another, we ultimately only have Garrison's claim that they were working together on it. But what we do know is we do know that Mary Sherman was very close to Sarah Stewart and Bernice Eddy, and they were the ones that discovered the contamination of the polio vaccine. And what I theorize from that is they tried to do what Sabin did, which was to isolate a benign strain. It's interesting to know that genetic engineering and recombination and all that stuff that was developed about genetic knowledge was all done by taking apart one virus, and that is the SV40 virus. And so I think it's very clear that the people handing out the money knew that this was the problem, and that's why they funded the genetics engineering taking apart that one virus. The use of the linear particle accelerator was to speed up the mutation process to see if they could find a benign strain, because it wasn't mutating fast enough and they were in a hurry. And what's interesting to me is that Gerald Myers, who's in charge of the HIV database at the Los Alamos Laboratories, describes HIV-1 as having been fast-forwarded. And I realize this is later in our discussion.
Yeah, we're going to be coming to this in our next segment.
But the point is, using radiation mutates stuff. That was determined in 1928. That was not news. The question is, did these people purposely put monkey viruses in a beam of radiation in order to mutate them and then inject them into the mice to find out what happened? If they did, it's a very serious situation and it needs to be investigated.
We should note, too, they recall for listeners the physical proximity of Dr. Mary Sherman's path to Tulane, David Ferry's apartment, the apparent laboratory site across the street, as well as the connections between people like Mary Sherman, Alton Oxner, Guy Bannister, and David Ferry and the Kennedy assassination milieu. So it may have been in connection with the SV40, a monkey virus contamination of the polio vaccine, the Sabin vaccine, that is not only responsible for the epidemic of soft tissue cancers that you have discussed, but it may have been that precise focal point that the Mary Ferry Association was created to investigate.
Mm-hmm.
We have been speaking with Ed Haslam, the author of Mary Ferry and the Monkey Virus, the story of an underground medical laboratory published in softcover by the Wordsworth Press. We are going to carry this fascinating and critically important investigation still further and discuss the possibility of AIDS conceivably having resulted from some of these machinations. For Ed Haslam, this is Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.